Well, Mary asked me if I would say a few words about Larry Levis, who was here for 4 years, and who I knew, well, from the age of 18 till his death. I met him, yeah, when he was 18. He was an entering freshman at California State University of Fresno. He had a wonderful slang name for it, like shit tech or something. It wasn't a bad school. It wasn't a good school either. I don't think it was probably as good as this school. But like a lot of mediocre or bad schools, you could get a good education there because you found out who was good and you took them. But that wasn't the case with Larry and me. Larry wanted to be a poet, and he seemed to have known that. He's got an essay in which he describes how he made this determination. I've never believed it, that he sat up one night and wrote a poem, and he said, if there's one line here and it's any good, then I will be a poet. And I will be as good a poet as I can possibly be. I don't think it happened that way, but it's a wonderful story. I think it probably happened the way it happened with most of us, which is, I'm going to try and write poetry. And then he tried to write it, and he thought about other things, and he kept writing it, and he kept writing it. And, you know, the more he wrote it, the more hypnotized he became, the more needy he became to go on writing it. And, it isn't like a Bergman movie. You don't go to the window one morning and the light breaks and you say, I shall be a poet. I will be Tränströmer. You just hang in there and you do the best you can, and pretty soon you discover that you're doing pretty well. I remember Larry came into my office, and I didn't realize he was an entering freshman. And he asked me, what goes on in a poetry writing class? So I described the class to him. Then he said, he asked permission to smoke. People still smoked a lot then, but I had just quit. No, I take it back. I was still smoking. That's right. I would quit later that year. So I said, sure, go ahead. So he lit a cigarette, and he had a way of sort of thinking while walking. And he stood up. And he said, do you mind if I pace? I said, no. He was an unusual guy. He was very skinny then and quite beautiful. I mean, he had a beautiful face, beautiful eyes. He wore Levi's. He grew up on a ranch, and he was clearly a rural guy. And he put his hands in the back of his pockets. He'd already asked me about Hart Crane, Rambo, and T.S. Eliot. Well, most of my students don't ask me about him. Hart Crane or Rambo. Young people who are going to ask what goes on in a writing class. And he sort of paced back and forth, and he says, I think this is exactly the course I would like to take. I said, well, fine, take it. He said, oh, there's a problem. I said, what's the problem? He said, it's not open to me. I'm an entering freshman. See, he waited. So he was, there was a quality to him that was quite seductive. By this time, I loved him. So I said, well, I can deal with that. I can get you in. Okay, so he took the course. What were his early poems like? They were terrible, like everybody's early poems. They were quite romantic. The language was charged. The influence of Crane was obvious. But he began to, he was like a vacuum cleaner sucking up what was going on, and pretty soon he discovered James Wright. And Wright had an enormous influence on him at that time. And then Bly, and that the kind of poetry that today you might see in Field magazine, for example. He began to write. And the interesting thing was that he began to write it so successfully, so quickly. Once the models that he could appropriate were before him, he appropriated them with great skill. He once wrote a poem very much like a poem of mine. And not a very good poem by me either. And then he showed it to me and he said, does this remind you of a particular poem? I said, yeah, a mediocre poem by me in my first book. And he said, yeah, I thought so. And I never saw that poem again. Nor did I ever see him really write a poem like my poetry again. I mean, there were certain things in my poetry that I think that he took but it was never the line, and it was never the phrasing, the way he took the phrasing of James Wright. So, and at times, perhaps even the vision of James Wright. I didn't see what he was up to for a long time, to be frank. I mean, I really didn't. I didn't understand a lot of his poetry. I loved it. I thought it was enormously gifted. I'm talking about when he was, you know, his early 20s and late teens. At the end of that year, I went off to Spain for a year, and we had a correspondence. He wrote me, probably 6 or 8 times, and sent me poems. Unfortunately, I didn't save the letters. I didn't save any letters I got that year, and I regret that. And then 2 years later, I went back to Spain, spent another year, we corresponded, and I didn't save any of those letters. That was a mistake. But I didn't know Larry was going to become Larry. Although by 1968, I knew he was going to be special. That's when he graduated. And he went off to Syracuse, and he wrote me from Syracuse the second year I was in Spain. And we had a correspondence that continued to the end of his life. And I think in the early years of the correspondence, I was a great help to him. And in the later years, he was more of a help to me than I was to him. And I think he had more influence on me than I had on him later in our correspondence. What I drew from him was inspiration. I mean, I just found his poetry enormously inspiring and ambitious. The way that certain poems by William Carlos Williams, for example, rather later poems, could kind of fire me up. I reread them and I say, Jesus, what? A poem like The Desert Music, I say, oh man, there's so much you can do with such simple language. It's just extraordinary. I'm sure that none of the events that are described in The Desert Music really took place. I'm sure Williams made them all up, you know. As Larry made up most of the things in his poems. That's what the hell the imagination's for. Though enough did happen to him. You know, he traveled a lot. One of the most moving times I ever had with Larry was in Rome. He knew where I was staying, and he came to see me. I was in a hotel in Rome. And I don't remember how he knew where I was. That's lost to me. This is probably about 20 years ago. And I said, where are you staying? And he said, well, come, I'll show you. And he took me to this incredible crap hole that was right across from the railroad station, and the noise was incredible. And I said, Larry, why don't you come to my, what are you paying? And he was paying twice what I was paying, so he came to my hotel. And then he said, I took him to Keats' house, what's called the Keats' house. It's the house that Keats lived in and died in when he went to Rome to be, you know, to struggle against his tuberculosis and was mishandled by medicals. And he was very moved by that, as anybody would be. You know, there are a lot of us, the books that Keats had are there, and there are letters, and there are the drawings that Severin, that was the guy's name, who was sort of commissioned in Britain to go with Keats and to sort of look out for him. And then he said, have you ever gone to the grave? And I said, no. And he said, well, let's go. So he and I, my wife, found out how you get there on a bus. And we went to what's called a Protestant cemetery. And what was more moving than the graves themselves, which are moving, the stone bears that famous line, here lies one whose name is written water. And Severin's grave is there, as is Shelley's. And Severin says, you know, here lies a man who was Keats' friend or something. I mean, that's all he sort of distinguishes himself by. But he had some sort of minor position. It's like a cultural attaché for Britain in Rome. But there was a man who came in with 2 canes and was having a terrible time walking. And his wife kept saying to him, Herbert, why don't you just sit down? And Herbert kept saying, I've got to see the damn graves, for God's sake. It's Keats' grave. Where is it? And he was struggling. And he was an older guy, and he was feeble, and you thought he was about an inch from the grave himself. But God damn it, he had to see those graves. And he got there, and tears started streaming down his cheeks. And Larry and I and Franny were so moved by it, you know, and felt so lucky that we could just walk in and view these memorials. I'm sure there are other things you're interested in.
In your correspondence with him, what kinds of things did you all find you took up? Was it as specific as diction and line breaks and things like that, meter, or was it more content? Or?
Well, first thing, we were friends. We were friends before we were poets. So the first thing we took up was his love life, which was an eternal myth. His jobs, his search for publishers that he wanted. I mean, a lot of it was that kind of thing. I don't remember what I was writing him. I could go see, because he saved almost all my letters. And they're in the Berg Room in New York Public Library, and I have maybe 25 that he sent me that are there also. He would send me poems, and I would write on the poems. We rarely wrote about the larger things that involve poetry. That is, like, vision. Mostly we talk, it was a kind of practical criticism. This passage stinks. These lines are no good. You can do better than this. The rhythm here is screwed up. It was things like that. Or, you know, where the hell is this going? You know, you've gone off track. I mean, this part is interesting. This is boring. And we were very frank with each other. We never pulled punches. That's the way I teach. I'm very frank with my students. Some of them don't like it. My feeling about it is that, you know, they're at NYU, for example, there are 13 people in the room, and one is getting paid to be there. So 12 of them can lie. That's fine, you know. But the other one, you know, he's got to, when I say tell the truth, he has to state the truth of his beliefs, his feelings, his responses. Not that he has some large truth that he could withhold or grant them. But, yeah, it was very practical criticism. I never questioned where his poems were going and why, for example, in the last two books, they got as dark as they got. They got very dark. You know, something crawled in there that suggested desperation, hopelessness. Sometimes you could almost say even a sense of worthlessness, because that wasn't evident when I was with him. He was a very upbeat guy, so it was a little surprising to find that in the poetry, but I never questioned it. He was a pro. He knew what he was doing. That's what he wanted to say. It wasn't mine to say, be more cheerful, for example. But we were living in an ugly world, and the older we got, the more aware of it. I think also he was unhappy in Salt Lake City. I think it was not a place that he found welcoming. And I don't want to step on anybody's toes, but I think the pervasiveness of the Mormon faith in the town was something that ran against his notions of who we are as people. And the power, you know, it is almost a theocracy there, and he didn't like that. I don't know what he was. He grew up as a Catholic, but I never knew him to go to church, for example, to take communion or anything like that. So I guess he was a fallen Catholic. He would use phrases like mea culpa. And sometimes he would talk about, jokingly, his education in the church as a boy. But like many of us who grew up in a church, as I did too, given the opportunity to say goodbye to it, we gladly said goodbye to it. And that was my sense of him. You know, his love life was a mess. He was a very attractive man, so women were drawn to him. And he didn't seem to have the ability to separate the ones who might do him good from the ones who might do him harm. And so, you know, it was just a crapshoot for such a bright guy. And you had to sit there and watch it, you know. He came to me once. This is a ridiculous story. He came to me once when he was a senior in college. And he said, I'm going out with two women. And I'm very intimate with them both. You know who they are. I said, yeah, sure, because I'd seen him with both of them. One of them was they were both my students, come to think. They were in different classes. And they got together with me and said, you have to make a choice, one or the other. What do I do? I said, you feel the need to make a choice? He said, no. I said, then don't make one. I mean, you know, it's like tennis. You hit the ball back into their court. Then I told him about a movie called The Captain's Wives or something, an Alec Guinness movie. It's a wonderful movie. It's about a guy who runs a ship between Spain and Gibraltar and what's the Moroccan city? It's a city with a reputation for being a hot spot. You know, a lot of drugs. It's a city that was, that's both French and Spanish, too. Those are the languages that are spoken there. And he's got a wife in each city. And in Gibraltar, he lives like an English, middle-class English gentleman. And when he gets to whatever the hell it is, his whole demeanor changes and he goes out dancing with his other wife who speaks Spanish and has got these dark hair and dark eyes and is beautifully stacked and everything. And they go out and party all night long, and then he takes the ship back the next day. And as they cross a certain line, he flips his photograph. He's got the photograph of each one, and then one faces him, he changes it. Captain's Paradise, that's what it's called. And I described the movie to him, and I said, Larry, you're living in a captain's paradise. And so he did what I advised, and he didn't do anything. And one of them made a choice, and it was the wrong one. He was a very upbeat guy, in spite of how dark the late poetry was. He was not the best Red student I ever had as a youngster. David St. John, who became a very close friend of his, was the most amazingly well-read entering freshman I ever came across. His grandfather was a Milton scholar, and his grandfather and his grandmother had separated, so the grandfather lived with David and David's father and mother and pushed books on David. So David, I mean, here's an entering freshman, and David looked younger than he was. He's a very small man, physically. And here he knew Milton and Wordsworth and Keats and Shelley and, you know, George Herbert and all this stuff. The Milton scholar was also a 17th century expert, etc. He had been the chairman of the English department just before I came to Fresno State. David was absolutely extraordinary. He was more visibly talented in a way than Larry. For example, he once showed me a poem by Philip Larkin that I had never seen before. And it turned out it wasn't by Philip Larkin. It was by David. He did an imitation of Larkin that was so good. And I loved Larkin. I was always yelling about, you got to read Larkin, etc. It was so good. And Larkin is a difficult poet to capture that extraordinary formal mastery, along with that irony and that sort of, and a kind of mood that you wouldn't associate with a 19-year-old guy. I mean, it's a very soured adult's vision of the world. Why do there have to be young people? Is basically, you know, what Larkin is saying. can't we all be born into middle age as I was? You know, Larry, no matter what happened in his life, he wrote. No matter what. He'd come and see me and, you know, he's getting divorced, da-da-dee, da-da-da. Will you look at these new poems? and they had nothing to do with his daily life, where he hated the job and da-da-da. And here were these poems. That was something that just went on and was him. So in a curious way, he had a more profound sanity, or whatever it is that a poet needs to persevere, than St. John, or than anyone else I think I've ever known. Well, Berryman had it. Berryman was an absolute wreck. I mean, he was one of the most wrecked. There's a line in T.S. Eliot, my nerves are bad tonight. That was Berryman. His nerves were bad night, morning, you name it. I mean, he was always shaking. And he was constantly taking drugs. He had a thing that was shaped like a can of that Copenhagen stuff that people chew. But it wasn't that. It was just a sort of little thing, and it screwed. And he would unscrew it. And it was divided into all these little compartments with tiny little dots of drugs in each compartment. And he'd lick his finger and then go, doot, 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 doot. He'd make this cocktail, suck it off his finger, and then wait about, and he says, okay, we'll go on now. He'd do it right in class. It was incredible. People say, what the hell is he doing? And he's smoking at the same time. He was wrecked. And yet he wrote constantly and lied that he wasn't writing, even when he was. He was always writing. So he did have a kind of sanity, at least in regard to that. He didn't handle his personal affairs very well either, Mr. Berryman.
Phil, I know that in that Berryman essay you wrote, you talk a lot about going to Iowa. I guess it was probably the late 40s or early 50s?
It was 1953.
So you were probably in that, maybe the first generation of people who studied creative writing in any kind of formal way. And I guess maybe I'm asking for the sake of people here, how things were then and how they're different now in that discipline or whatever you call it.
Well, one of the differences, I think, was I taught it in Iowa in 1992, and the class that I was in was in the 50s was very different in terms of just the age of the students. Many of the students were vets from World War II, so they were much older. And some of the people, a woman like Jane Cooper, for example, had been teaching professionally for many years. She was probably about 30. Snodgrass was a vet. He was probably 30. Justice was about three or four years older than I. I was 26, and I was one of the youngest guys. There's another difference. I think there were 12 of us, and 10 of us were men. Now when I teach at NYU, it's rare that I have a class with as many men as women. Then it was very rare that there were as many women as men. There were almost, it was, you just didn't see that. I went back in the 50s, and you could say studied with Paul Engle, and that was hopeless. He was useless. He had no real interest in our poetry, and we had no interest in what he said about it because his own poetry was so wretched. But we were interested in how much money he could hand out, and we were interested in what the other students had to say because there were some very good students there. I think that workshop that I took with Berryman especially was most interesting in the aspect of how good the fellow students were. I got a lot from Berryman, but I also got a lot from Justice and a lot from a poet named Bill Dickey, who's dead now, lived in San Francisco later on. It was very sharp. Snodgrass is not the sort of person who would give anybody anything, so I didn't get anything from Snodgrass. But Justice at that time was rather a nice guy. It was a big, heavy-set guy named Don Peterson who thought he was Ivor Winters. But it was good to get that sort of neoclassic, plain-style vision from Peterson, who really did know Winters. So the students were a very opinionated group. Lowell let the class sort of run itself because what we took for boredom on his part was really, you know, a psychic drama that was going badly. And he just didn't have the energy to focus on our poetry. I'm sure that later in life, when he got, you know, the kind of drugs that could control the bipolar thing he had, he became a much better teacher. I've heard that, but he was terrible. But I think the biggest difference, it's hard for me to say because I'm so much older than Berryman was. Berryman only turned 40. He was still a very young guy. He turned 40 during the semester. Lowell was younger than Berryman. He was probably about 37. Surprises me to think of how young they really were. Berryman had not really published yet his best stuff. I mean, you couldn't even tell how good he was going to be at that moment until Partisan Review published Homage to Mistress Bradstreet. And then we saw, oh my God, he's not just the poet who published that first book, The Un-something or other, which is a bad sort of, well, a very competent amalgamation of the influences of Yeats and W.H. Auden. Berryman's class differed from the kind of class that I've seen or visited in that he was very commanding. He absolutely took charge. I mean, everything proceeded exactly the way he wanted it to proceed. A lot of times there were lectures. There was a lot of sort of seminar-like questioning. Levine, he would say, how would you go about finding criticism on the poet Charles Churchill? I mean, he'd ask a question like that. Levine, you're a scholar. Yeah, I remember that's how he once asked me to go up to the board and write a footnote. You're going to be teaching in a graduate level, or else you're going to continue being a driver. Now, we want to make a teacher out of you. So let's see how you can write a footnote. You have read these lines from Yeats in an anthology by so-and-so. Let's see how you put that in a footnote. I said, why don't I just go to Yeats? And no, but you didn't. And then he would laugh because he didn't take it all that seriously. But and he had a very definite, I'll say something else for him. He read our poems very closely so that everything we were trying to do, he seemed aware of, and he seemed aware of where we ran out of gas or where we failed. And his candor was incredible. I had never taken poetry writing before. There was no poetry writing offered at Wayne University where I went as an undergraduate. So this is my first experience. Lowell was my first poetry writing teacher. I had shown my poetry to a couple of guys on the Wayne campus, faculty people who wrote poetry. But it was just one-on-one kind of thing. And they lied to me. I mean, they said the poems were very good. The poems were not very good. They may have been better than the poems that they were shown by other students, but they weren't good. But I don't think they felt the personal authority that Berryman felt unlimited personal authority. I mean, he thought he knew everything. And in a way, he deserved it. I mean, he was a brilliant man and a terrific scholar, a Shakespearean scholar. And he was incredibly well-read, and he had a wonderful memory. It would break down now and then, but rarely when he was sober. He was always sober in class, by the way. Whatever else you read about him, he took class very seriously, and he always came sober. And gave it hell. I mean, he really worked hard in class. There would be discussion. I think another nice thing about it is Iowa City is a small town. It was certainly very small then. And so it was very easy for us as a group to meet two or three of the others whose work we liked, to get together and talk about our poems individually. And that's more, I got more from my fellow students outside of class than in class with Berryman, not with Lowell, because Lowell didn't say much of anything. Lowell sort of had an extended yawn that began the first time we met him and continued. Probably until his nervous breakdown, which did not take place during that semester. I think the seriousness was a difference, too. Because we tended to be older, we were more serious about what we wanted to do. That a number of the students were married. Some had children. I mean, so they were embarking on this venture with a lot at stake, in a way. It was an unusually talented group. I mean, you know, if you're in a class with Snodgrass and Justice, and this guy Dickey, and a poet named Melvin Walker La Follette, a poet named Henry Collette, a poet named Paul Petrie, I think almost everybody in the class went on to publish at least a book. One guy died very young, but he, too, published a book. One of the most gifted was this guy Melvin Walker La Follette, who gave up poetry. He became an Episcopal minister, and he works on the Tex-Mex border. He was the wackiest guy in the class and a lot of fun.
When you began to feel like you wanted to take in those influences but then also carve out some separate territory for yourself, who were some of the poets you began to look to and how did that process start?
I think it started with Williams. Williams was not a poet that any of my teachers had ever promoted. I mean, Berryman never talked about him. Lowell never talked about him. Lowell would write about him later on. And so Williams was a discovery of my own. And it came about in an odd way. I didn't know Williams' poetry at all. I was in love with a very different kind of poetry. I was 23 maybe, 23 or 4. And the poet I was in love with was Dylan Thomas, who was then touring in the United States and had come to Detroit and hypnotized us. I sort of saw him and had a little tiny contact with him, but there were so many people around him, especially young women, that I wasn't up to fighting my way through. So I had a teacher who was a very close friend of a close friend of Dylan Thomas's. His name was Oscar Williams. He was a very... Yeah, the anthologist, who was also a very minor poet. The only place you'd find his poetry today is in his own anthologies, where he and his wife, Jean Deerwood, would occupy many, many pages. Now, William Carlos Williams, being cursed with exactly the same name, had one poem in his famous little anthology of modern poetry. Williams, WCW, has one poem. Oscar has like 20. So my teacher says, I tell my teacher, I'm going to New York. I want to hear, I got to hear Dylan Thomas again. I mean, I was just, he said, my friend Oscar Williams is very close to him, because Williams was almost like an agent of his here in America, publishing him and everything. So he gave me a letter to give as an introductory letter that I would give to Oscar Williams. And then I would meet Dylan Thomas. Right? Well, I get to the 92nd Street Y, which is, you know, still this sort of place where readings were held. And the place was mobbed. Dylan Thomas just seized the American imagination the way I don't think anybody has. Maybe Seamus Heaney would fill it like that. And I went up to John Malcolm Brennan, who was the guy who was a poet who ran the 92nd Street Y. And I said, is the poet Williams here? And he said, Oscar or the great Williams? And that really resounded, the great Williams. So I, you know, did I meet Dylan Thomas? No, I didn't meet him again, you know. I heard him twice, and it was disappointing because it was almost the same as, you know, I mean, these great jokes that were coming across, they were all rehearsed, right? They were part of the patter. And he looked even seedier than he had in Detroit. He didn't look the way a poet's supposed to look, whatever the hell that means. We had seen photographs of him. You know, high cheekbones, drawn face, black turtleneck sweater, a lot of wavy blonde hair. You know, he's the kind of guy who walked around in his own wind so the hair would blow, you know. You know. And who comes out on the stage but a tiny W.C. Fields? A guy with a very red nose, rotund, piss-stained trousers, a soup-stained tie. I mean, just looking dreadful, you know. And you go, oh, my God. And then the voice would open up. And the guy had the most extraordinary voice. It was hypnotic. And he said, yeah, that's the poet. Anyway, when I got back, I started reading Williams. And there were a number of poems I just fell in love with. And I thought, this is something I haven't seen. And I just kept them in my mind. Poems like Widow's Lament in Springtime, On the Road to the Contagious Hospital. Poems like that, that I thought, they don't use meter. I was writing metrical poems. They don't use meter, they don't use rhyme, but they have as much music as anything else going. And another poet that I then discovered who was enormously helpful to me was Theodore Retke, what are called his greenhouse poems. Again, I saw free verse being handled in a way that made it as rich as anything that was metrical and anything that was rhymed and gave it as much texture and weight as anything I'd ever read. And then somebody, and I don't remember who it was, said to me, if you want to see the source of Retke, you should read D.H. Lawrence. And so I began reading Lawrence very seriously. And there were two things there. There was not only the subtlety and the delicacy of the free verse, it was also his narrative poems. And the narrative poems just seized me. They were so extraordinary. Those great I'm not a guy who has much feeling for animals, you know? I mean, I like them on a plate. I didn't grow up on a farm. And I mean, there were horses when I grew up, but they were mainly, you know, they pulled milk trucks and then later on I did work at a racetrack for 4 years. So I worked for a woman who owned racehorses. So I got to see beautiful animals, but I found racehorses scary. They really were, they made me very nervous, very jumpy. They were so fractious themselves. But it was the way he handled the narrative and the way he put himself in the context of the narrative so that you had this secure point of view, but it wasn't the main issue. The main issue was the animal. So I think those were things that I, sort of discoveries that I made that were extraordinarily important to me. And another poet whose narratives I really loved was Robert Penn Warren. I didn't much care what Robert Penn Warren was saying. And sometimes I thought the poems were so confused he wasn't saying anything. He had a little book with a title like 11 Poems on the Same Theme, and they were narrative poems that went all over the place. I mean, they had these wonderful jumps in them, and I just loved the structures of them. I didn't know what he was doing. The way I really didn't know what Dylan Thomas was doing either. I remember one day I sat down and I said to myself, my favorite poem by Dylan Thomas was A Refusal to Mourn the Death by Fire of a Child in London. And I sat down and I said, I wonder what this means. Never until the mankind making bird, beast, and flower, and blah, blah, blah. And it just goes on thundering away. And I must enter again the round Zion of the water beat in the synagogue of the ear of corn shall I let pray the shadow of a sound or sow my salt seed in the least valley of sackcloth to mourn the majesty and burning of the child's death. I skipped half the sentence, but it's all one sentence. And I looked at that thing and I said, I wonder where the verb is. Let me approach this as a statement, you know, with grammar. And I started to parse the poem. And son of a bitch, I understood it. I had just been reading it and becoming intoxicated by its texture and its imagery, the round Zion of the water bead in the synagogue of the ear of corn, you know. I thought, oh Jesus. Or images from the poem After the Funeral to his aunt, Anne Jones. You know, her fist of a face died clenched on a round pane. Oh, I mean, I would just see these images and say, holy cow, what a gift for metaphor this son of a bitch has. And then as I got older, I got demanding. I wanted to see I wanted to figure him out. And so I went to the criticism. It was useless. It would talk about the vision in these large forms and never really go after the poems themselves. So you began to realize that the best critics were all dead. They were named Samuel Taylor Coleridge, William Hazlitt, Samuel Johnson, and the rest of criticism you could have. Well, folks, that's all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.